Okay, thanks. I'm Leslie, I'm an addict. It was really great to hear Frankie, because I'm really, really overtired, and I walked in and I thought, I felt that there were sort of two options for tonight, really. One was that I kind of, you know, keep tight control and really don't share very much about myself, or probably let myself feel how I feel and end up crying, you know. And so it was great to come in and hear Frankie say, you know, I cry, because I can feel that that's an unacceptable thing to do. You know, one of the great things about coming to NA is being a part of something, you know. Not I walked in here tonight and I was quite nervous, you know. I don't know a lot of people here. There are quite a few people here that I do know, and it's a very big meeting, you know. And I've had a really, really busy week at work, and there are some people here that I really love, and that I feel love me, and. You know, that's a fantastic thing. NA has done, you know, there's a saying that NA has done for me things that I cannot do for myself. And one of the things that I've, you know, that I was never able to do for myself, I'm not quite sure about this feeling about, you know, I mean, I wouldn't do affirmations about, you know, loving myself or something like that. But, you know, being able to care for myself, being able not to feel that I should destroy myself because I'm so worthless, you know, that really is a lot of what my addiction was about. And I didn't know that at the time. And, you know, and sometimes that comes back to me. And it comes back to me when I feel frightened, particularly, you know, I feel worthless. And the fantastic thing, I think, about NA is that, you know, I don't have to be better than anyone else or worse than anyone else. You know, I'm just another recovering addict. And that's such an incredible freedom, because a lot of my life has been about, you know, sizing myself up against other people, you know. You know. In any situation, sizing my, you know, the only thing that I ever thought that I did well, and it's, you know, a really pathetic thing to think. I used to think that I could drink and drug, you know, any man under the table kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? What a kind of pathetic thing to feel proud of. There wasn't really very much else, you know, that I thought that I could do well. But, you know, I felt that I could keep going, you know, pretty well. You know, I don't want to say a lot about using. I was, I sort of grew up in the 60s. I wasn't quite old enough to be a hippie, but I desperately wanted to be. And I started coming up to London and smoking dope, I guess, when I was about 15. I come from a family, neither of my parents really used, but my father came from a family of very heavy drinkers and alcoholics in sort of northeast London. And my mother came from a family of women who had a lot of emotional problems. A lot of the women in my mother's family have had emotional, you know, emotional problems and mental problems. And I've heard this on the tape about addicts, but I mean, really, my parents were like two sick children who sort of came together, you know. And so there wasn't a lot of using in my direct family. And when I got into recovery, I couldn't really understand why it was that I'd done the things that I'd done. I found out, you know, I found out quite a lot about my family since I've been in recovery. You know, I had a cousin. I never even knew he existed until he died. He was living in a car, chronic alcoholic, probably using as well. I don't know. You know, he drank himself to death living in a car. You know, that's the thing, isn't it, about addict and alcoholic families? They don't kind of talk about things. When I was a child, my grandmother used to have Christmas parties, and the kids used to be allowed to do the bar, and I used to drink, you know, I used to mix up snowballs, add vodka and lemonade, isn't it? I used to absolutely love them, you know, and I was about sort of 11 or 12, and one year I got so drunk I passed out in the toilet, you know, and they had to take the door off the hinges to get me out. No one ever mentioned it to me. I only found that out in recovery. Another example of that is, when I was using, I had a child, and I took him into school one day, and I was talking to one of his teachers, and she said, you know, the things kids tell you about what happens at home, and she said, you know, the funny thing about Ben is he never says anything about what happens at home. And I thought, thank God, you know. They're addicts and alcoholic families, I guess. So I lived out of London. I started coming up to London and smoking dope. Taking acid. I was like a sort of little sort of junior hippie, really. I was at work today. I was talking to my director at work, and I've been listening to a lot of Crosby, Stills and Nash just recently, and he's listening to this David Crosby album, and we were talking about, you know, what great music and the band and, you know, the things that the band did, and it just made me think, you know, what I was doing at that time and what this guy was saying he was doing at this time, you know, and how, you know, our lives just kind of went, you know, that was kind of the sort of, you know, beginning of my using, really. See, he feels that that's a sort of similar point about us. He doesn't really know a lot about my background. So I did that. I do a bit of H&I, and one of the things I used to share in H&I was that actually one of the things that I think about me being an addict isn't that I ended up a heroin addict or that I injected. One of the things I think about it is when I was a kid, I started smoking dope and I absolutely loved it. You know, I absolutely loved it. And after a little while, it started making me quite paranoid. I used to get heart palpitations. I used to feel very uncomfortable in myself. I didn't really know what that was. I found it quite sort of frightening. I didn't talk to anyone about it. I carried on smoking dope. I carried on smoking dope until I found something else that, you know, made me feel better. I started taking speed, actually. But I carried on doing that, even though it made me uncomfortable. And I knew it would make me uncomfortable. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd roll a joint, you know, before I'd do whatever it was I was doing during the day. I will do things that just go against my experience. I just will, you know. I all through my addiction, you know, I smoked dope. I smoked that. It made me very paranoid. I stopped doing it when I met a boyfriend who was dealing blues and mandrax, you know, and I started taking pills. I then started injecting speed. I then thought I would die doing that. I loved it so much. I became completely paranoid on it, you know. Thought the TV was giving me messages, all that kind of stuff. I've got this convention tape, and in it the guy says, I never asked anyone for help when I was using, and I always found my own solutions to my own problems, and my solutions were generally worse than the problems they were trying to solve. And that was really true for me, you know. I just that sort of cycle of self-medication, you know, I got very, very paranoid on speed. I started taking gear, you know, I started taking heroin, you know, that was my kind of answer to the paranoia. It was a fine solution for a while. It became a problem in its own right. And in the middle of that, I had a little boy. I actually got married and had a little boy, which I think is quite a good sort of, you know, order of things to happen in addiction. Things were sort of going wrong. I decided it was the guy that I was with, and really, you know, things went from bad to worse, really. There were times in my addiction where if I'd known something about recovery, I would have come into recovery. Once I had a little boy, I was very, very... I was very nervous of getting involved with authority, you know, in any way. I knew that there was a good chance that, you know, that my son would be taken away from me if anyone kind of knew what I was doing. So, you know, I couldn't ask for help. You know, I felt that I couldn't ask for help. And, you know, so sort of sometimes things were okay. A lot of the time things were very chaotic. I felt very bad about myself if I stopped to think about what I was doing, dragging this little kid, around with me. We were at home one day. There was a knock at the door. I answered the door. A whole load of guys burst in with knives, held us at knife point. Threatened to kill us. I really believe that they, unbelievably, I really believe that they were going to seriously harm us. I couldn't give up the gear that we had. I just couldn't give up the gear, you know. After about 4 hours, I took them out. I got some money, and I gave them the money. You know, my son was kind of screaming, "Don't go, mummy, don't go," you know. You know, I felt really, really bad about things like that. Really, really so bad. And what I did about it was I had another hit, you know, because I didn't have any tools for living. I didn't have any way of kind of dealing with the way that I felt about things. What happened was, I had another knock on the door another day, only this time it was the police. And I'd been arrested before, but this time I was in the police station with my son. And a lot of my friends who were kind of involved in the same sort of things that I was involved in were having their children taken into care. And actually, I'd seen that happen to three or four women that I'd known at that time. And I really believed that would happen to me. And I was incredibly lucky. You know, the police let my sister come and pick up my son, and that didn't happen. My lawyer said, he thought I would get a custodial sentence, and I didn't get a custodial. You know, I mean, I just had a series of kind of very, very lucky sort of breaks around that. My sister came and lived with me for a while. She was really fantastic, actually. And she got me to see this, I don't know what the woman was, some sort of therapist, because what I couldn't understand was how I had got to that point again. Because a couple of years before, I had given up, you know, I had given up using. And the thing was, you know, I'd never heard anything about, you know, the idea of total abstinence. But you know, I didn't have a habit for a while, I tried to sort of get away from the people I'd known who were using, and I'd tried going back to college, and it hadn't worked. You know, kind of I started using again at the weekend. You know, the sort of same old sort of story. You know, I just ended up back where I'd always been, but I just couldn't believe that, you know, that I'd put in so much effort. You know, I'd really, really tried to kind of stay away from people, like go back to college. You know, I'd really tried to sort myself out, and I'd ended up, you know, in a worse position than I'd ever been in before. And I went to see this therapist who kept saying to me, "You must be very angry." And actually, I really had absolutely no idea what she was talking about. And so that didn't work. My sister told everyone. She told my ex-husband. She told my parents. Oh, no, she didn't. She made me tell my parents exactly what had been going on, which was you know, really unbelievably. I don't know whether it was traumatic or it was freeing. You know, my parents were in serious denial. My father once said to me, "What are those marks up your arm?" And at the time, I think I weighed maybe 7.5 stone. You know, it's about 4 or 5 stone less than, was it? Oh, I don't want to say I weigh that much. It was quite a lot less than I weigh now. And I was skinny, and I had these marks. My father said, "What are those marks up your arm?" I said, "Nothing." He went, "Oh, okay." I kind of had to tell them what had been going on, and my father said, "I knew something had been going on," you know. That meant that really I had to do something. You know, I had to do something about it. And what I did is, I did a methadone detox. I got some sleeping pills. I kind of got over the sort of physical addiction. In its own way, that was a big rock bottom. That was a big rock bottom. But it wasn't the one that got me into recovery. What got me into recovery was I then had 6 months, and actually, what, you know, I in many ways I got myself together. I wasn't using gear. I got a job. My parents and family and non-using people were really, you know, were saying, "Oh God, it's so fantastic. You know, you've sorted yourself out. That's just so amazing. You know, well done." Inside, I felt terrible. I have to say, I had about 6 months before I started coming to NA. I would say that was the most difficult 6 months of my life. I just couldn't deal with life. I just couldn't deal with being around other people. I couldn't look people in the eye. I couldn't just have a kind of casual chat with people. I just felt so uncomfortable in my own skin. In step one, it says social acceptability does not equal recovery. And what happened was, you know, I got a bit of social acceptability, but, you know, God, that sentence really, really rings true with me, because it was just... it was so difficult. It's such a difficult time, and after everything else that had happened, I had a real, real emotional, spiritual rock bottom. I just found it increasingly difficult to get out of bed in the morning. You know, I used to come home, get in bed and start crying, and my little boy used to say to me, "Don't worry, Mummy, it'll be all right, it'll be all right." You know, I just think that's really pathetic, you know, a little boy saying that. Anyway, it got to a point, actually, where I'd started drinking, and I'd started drinking alcoholically, and, you know, and I'm not a very good drinker. I started doing things that I just felt, every time I drank, I did things that just made me feel worse and worse and worse about myself, you know, and it ended up with this sort of massive drinking binge with this guy, I just feel really bad about myself, about everything that happened that night. And then a couple of days later, I saw something on TV about 12-step treatment, and it reminded me that a couple of years before, I'd been to an NA meeting in a hospital at the back of Kensington High Street. And I'd been there because I'd been to court with a boyfriend, and we bumped into an old friend of his, and he said he was going to these meetings, and we'd gone along, and I sat there thinking, "Oh my God, you know, this really, really..." What a girl in the meeting, I can remember, I mean, you know, this is sort of 23, 24 years ago, a girl in the meeting was sharing about whether she should kneel to pray. I thought, "My God, what is this? You know, this is so not for me." And I went away, and I had absolutely no intention of going back. But I got to this point where I was absolutely beaten. I had, you know, I had just absolutely run out of any solutions to any of the problems that I had. I just did not know what to do. And I went back to this meeting, you know, and the amazing thing about meetings, and I thought this when Frankie was saying about footsteps, you know, about that footsteps thing, is that, you know, NA is that sort of higher power that is always here. You know, you know, we might go off and do all sorts of things, but it's always here. You know, you could, you know, you know, the answer for me has always been in these meetings. You know, the number of times when I've walked into meetings, I thought, oh, I, you know, I just really don't know what to do, and sat down and listened to someone share, and, you know, and just heard something that just reminds me, you know, what I need to be doing. You know, my sponsor says, we just need to keep on being reminded about this stuff, you know. You know, I've been coming to meetings for a while. I've worked steps, you know, I've read the book. But it doesn't take me very long away from meetings that I sort of forget all of that, you know, and I'm kind of, you know, running away, trying to sort of sort out my own problems, getting caught up in things. You know, I need somewhere where I can sort of come and sit down and listen to other people and just get a bit of perspective on things. So I ended up in meetings. I mean, for me, NA for me has just been a series of amazing coincidences and sort of opportunities. First meeting I went to, there was a guy in the meeting who I'd had my first ever hit in his house when I was 19. I was 31 when I got into recovery. I'd seen him in Westbourne Grove when I'd gone to the late night supermarket there and crossed the road, because he was in such a state. I thought, I really don't want anything to do with this guy. You know, I was using, but he was really, really bad. You know, he was 6 months clean. He was in this meeting, he was 6 months clean. The woman who was doing a chair was a woman, we'd both been pregnant at the same time, and we both sort of used through our pregnancy and kind of both told each other that was okay. And she became my sponsor. There was another woman in the meeting who'd been in my flat that last time there'd been a knock on the door and the police had been there. You know, it's like a history of my addiction in that meeting. Or a history of my drug use, not necessarily my addiction. I didn't get clean from the, you know, I was smoking a bit of dope. That's all I was doing. I was smoking a bit of dope. I didn't even like doing it. I came to meetings for 6 months and carried on doing it. I mean, I find that absolutely insane. You know, I wasn't even enjoying it. I had an emotional connection to drugs. You know, I really, really believe that. The thing that really hammered that home to me was the last time I gave up smoking, I got into this, I'd given up smoking a couple of times, I then got into this completely sort of, I couldn't breathe, but I couldn't stop smoking. And in the end, I went to this sort of NHS smoking clinic, and they said, keep a smoking diary about when you smoke. And I sort of wrote all this stuff down. I thought, my God, it's like, you know, my cigarettes are like this little friend of mine that sits on the chair beside me. And, you know, other people let me down, but my cigarettes are there. And, you know, and I've always had that kind of connection. There's something outside myself that will make me feel better, you know. And so that was a good lesson for me, really. You know, that was another thing that just helped me sort of see what addiction has done to me. And in a way, I think it was another sort of level of faith, you know, another sort of letting go and having to sort of rely on higher power. And for me, that has been a fantastic thing in recovery, you know, a relationship with a higher power. The first time I worked step 6 and 7, you know, that for me was a real, there have been loads of sort of turning points for me in recovery, loads of things that have happened to me in recovery, but I did this sort of step 4 and 5, there are so many things I could say about recovery, but I did this step 4 and 5, and around my first sort of 6 and 7, I realised that actually I'd never been able to really to sort of name emotions. I'd felt things, but I'd never really been able to, to identify what was happening with me and be able to say, oh yes, I'm feeling, you know, like this or like that. What I realised was that I was completely driven by sort of fear and, you know, and self-hate, and that I needed to change. And I was really, you know, there were things that I was really frightened of. I was really frightened of letting myself feel my feelings, and I can't really even describe that, but I really had this feeling, you know, that actually if I, you know, really let go and just let myself feel my feelings, that in some ways that would destroy me, you know, that I would be destroyed by all of this sort of feeling. And the other thing was just letting go and not having any expectations about what would happen or who I would be, what sort of person I would become, you know, just letting go and believing that things would be okay. The sponsor I've got now, you know, when she first started being my sponsor, you know, I went through the steps with her and I did a step 7 then, and that was a really fantastic experience for me. My experience in working the steps and what I see from sponsees is that, you know, as you work the steps, life gives you opportunities to kind of experience, you know, what those steps mean, which I think is, you know, don't hang around in step 1 and step 6. You know, they can be really, really painful steps. And you know, I was going through a really, really difficult time, you know, when I was working step 6, and I just couldn't sort of, it just felt to me that that I was trying to make things better and everything I did made it worse. And I think that was probably part of the problem, you know. And I had a green and gold book, and I was away somewhere, and I was going through the questions, and there's a brilliant question in there that says, you know, do you believe that a God of your understanding can help you with this? And I wrote, you know, if it can't, then I am really fucked, because I really don't know, you know, what to, you know, how I'm going to sort out the things that are happening at the moment. And somehow just doing that made everything change. And that was a really profound change for me, because actually since then I have never been, oh God, I hate to say this, you know, touch wood and everything, but I have never been in that space again. You know, I really, really do believe that this is a spiritual, you know, that this program is a spiritual solution to the, you know, to the problem of addiction. You know, that's a great thing. I've started doing a meditation class just recently, which is also fantastic. There's loads I could say about that. I won't go on about that. But that's been a very good thing, you know, doing a sort of regular meditation every day. You know, service in NA, I'll just say a little bit about that. I've done a bit of service in NA, and just recently I've got involved I take an H&I meeting once a month, and I'm treasurer for the UK convention, and my experience is that, you know, a lot of the time I think, oh, I really haven't got time to do this, you know, I'm really, really busy. The reason that I kind of stopped being so involved in NA is that my father was very, very ill, and then he died, you know, and I gave up a couple of commitments so that I could spend more time with him, and then he died, and then, you know, it was very sort of difficult around my family and my mother, and anyway, I've got involved in NA again, and it's just been absolutely fantastic. I have to say, it's they're both great in their own ways. You know, being on a committee is great because there's a group of you and you kind of get together and you meet up and you sort of plan all of this stuff, and then suddenly there's like a really, you know, there's a big convention, you know, and it's like you've kind of, you know, it's like kind of throwing a great party and having loads of people there. You know, that's a really, really good thing. And H&I is fantastic because, you know, doing a chair like this, you know, like Frankie said, in some ways I find it difficult doing chairs in meetings because there's always a part of me that thinks, oh, you know, am I saying the right thing? You know, that sort of mad stuff. You know, an H&I actually isn't, you know, is so much not about me, you know. It's just, you know, you just get so much back from talking to people who, you know, who are at that point that I was at, you know, how did I end up here again? You know, what am I going to do? And knowing that there's, you know, knowing that there's an answer. I mean, people may not want this answer, but, we just carry a message. I'll just say one last thing. I think I'm coming to the end. When I first got clean, you know, my sister was like a kind of my warden for a little while. You know, she kind of checked who was phoning up and who was coming round and stuff like that. You know, she moved in with me. She was absolutely fantastic, I have to say. You know, she came into this flat, you know, where, oh God, she was asthmatic. She went, I just can't live in this place, it's so disgusting, you know, kind of cleaned it all up for me, looked after me, you know, checked who was coming to the door, all that kind of thing. Just a little bit after I got into recovery, she met this guy and she got married and she had this little boy. And I thought, you know, and I was holding this little boy, you know, my little boy was 9 when I came into recovery, and I was holding this little boy and I thought, you know, this little boy never needs to see me use. He never needs to see me use. And that was a really, you know, that was a really fantastic thing. That was, you know, there were lots of things like that were kind of strength for me when I came into recovery. And anyway, he grew up, and when he sort of got into his teens, he started... he started going down the route that, you know, that I had gone down. You know, he started drinking. He started. He just started behaving oddly, and you know, it was obvious something was going on. And he came and stayed with me for a little while, and I took him to a few meetings. And you know, my sister just really didn't know what to do. And he decided it wasn't for him. And one day he, you know, he got unbelievably drunk, had a huge argument with my son, and just sort of walked out. And, you know, and then I kept hearing sort of little stories about where he was and what he was doing. And my mother kept saying, oh, you know, he goes out all the time, and it's really, you know, he's always borrowing money off me. And, oh, God, you know. And he kind of came to stay with me again, I guess about 18 months ago now, and decided, you know, that he was going to sort of get himself together, and he started going to meetings again, and a couple of weeks ago he did a year clean share at a meeting. You know, I mean, how fantastic is that? You know, I mean, that's a really, really amazing thing. You know, and he's so into it, you know. It's really fantastic. You know, when he was staying with me, it was absolutely brilliant. I don't see him as much now. When he was staying with me, he used to come home, give me little bits of advice about recovery. It was absolutely fantastic. You know, that's a really, really fantastic thing, isn't it? You know, the downside is, you know, obviously that I'm that much older since I came into recovery. You know, I sometimes share about my son, and then people come up and go, I share about my son and what I said to him, they go, oh yeah, my mother says that to me. And I think, oh my God, you know, you know, there we are. Anyway, you know, NA has been absolutely fantastic for me. You know, my wildest dreams have come true in recovery, you know, in many ways. I mean, at the moment, I've moved recently and I've got a vegetable patch, and now at the weekends, everything we have has to have vegetables out of the garden, you know. It's just so fantastic, you know. I just think things like that are just so, you know, such a satisfying thing to do. Things that I would never, you know. When I first got into recovery, a friend of mine said, he was someone I'd known when I was using, and he was about a year clean, and he said, what did he say to me? What do you do for fun? First of all, he said to me, what do you like about yourself? Which I thought was a really cruel thing to say to someone who was only sort of fairly new in recovery. And I still do think that's quite a cruel question. And, you know, what do you do for fun? And at the time I thought, oh God, I don't go out to clubs. But actually, you know, I've found things that I think are sort of fun and good for me. And I will end on this thing. I've got a group of friends, and we've all got about the same. We were all 21 years clean this year, and we've all decided that we're going to go out to a big London hotel where they do a big old fancy tea, and we're all going to have a big fancy 21 year clean tea after Christmas. And you know what a great thing that is. You know, I've got people that I've known, you know, for longer than I was using now. You know, recovery's just been great for me. I hope it is for you. Thank you.